Welcome to Profit Boss Radio, where successful women have paved the road to their own financial freedom. Each week, your host, Hillary Hendershot, financial coach, money mindset expert, and experienced wealth manager, will help you discover the keys to the wealth and peace of mind you want and deserve in her no-nonsense and authentic style. Starting right now.
Hello, Profit Boss. So a few weeks ago, I read an article that kind of rocked my world. And the very cool thing about having a radio show is that I can often go right to the source and get the author to talk to us here. And this is one of those days. Everyone knows what the gender pay gap is, these statistics about how women earn less money than men do. And in the same vein, it is so often said that investors and venture capitalists won't invest in women-founded startups like they do companies founded by men. And we assume that's because investors are short-sighted sexists. And so we as women start life with this huge assumed headwind. My guest today has research that is really going to astound you and kind of turn some of this data on its ear. Professor Sharon Poxter publishes a column called The Independent Economist and has spent the greater part of the last 15 years studying economics at Cornell, the London School of Economics, and UC Berkeley. Now she's a professor of managerial economics at Cornell. She teaches the fine art of business strategy from the vantage point of economics. She is fascinated by economic policy, and she writes about the implications of government intervention in the private sector, especially during financial crises. She's been published in peer-reviewed journals, as well as on Bloomberg, Fox News, and in the book Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. Enjoy. Sharon, welcome to Profit Boss Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start with a little bit of your personal background? Would you share with us what it's like to be a professor at Cornell? It sounds really impressive.
Being a professor at Cornell is wonderful. I think probably the most scintillating part about it are the students. So I teach in the Dyson School, which is the undergraduate business program here at Cornell. And the students, by and large, are really just these extremely motivated go-getters. So to work with them is really inspiring for me.
It's great. And is that why you selected academia as a career choice? I mean, with your intellect, I think probably choosing professorship probably cost you money in the long run. Was it the lifestyle?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it was a long road to get to kind of figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. It took me most of my 20s to kind of get to the idea that I should be a professor.
Really?
Yeah. I started out actually in management consulting. And I worked in the record industry. I did a bunch of different things. And then I kind of realized that I had to go back to school to get a PhD. So I ended up in academia. Partly, I think it was a calling. I was that nerdy 9-year-old, you know, with a blackboard in her room teaching an imaginary class every day. And my father's a professor. And so it kind of, I think it came a little bit naturally to me, but I just had to come to it on my own. And I also was pre-med in college, and I wanted to inspire people. I wanted to affect people's lives. And when I realized at university that I could do that by being a professor, that kind of became part of the genesis of me going back to school and figuring out that I wanted to be an academic.
What did you do in the record industry?
I actually worked at A&R at a hip-hop label called Tommy Boy Records, which doesn't exist anymore. It was subsumed by, I think, Sony. But yeah, I worked in A&R and publishing.
A&R being accounts receivable?
Oh, no, sorry. It's for artists and recruiting. So It was kind of scouting out new talent, writing up marketing reports to talk about whether certain spaces are the right venues for certain artists, things like that.
I see. You're a real Renaissance woman.
Tried a little bit of everything.
So I noticed in your Twitter profile, it says everything economics plus empowerment. What inspired you to write that? How do those things go together?
Well, I think it's just kind of thinking about what I'm the most passionate about. I've kind of been passionate about economics from a very, very early age, particularly in the context of developing countries and poverty and all of those questions. So economics has always been a passion of mine. And then kind of more recently, being involved in the gender debate that kind of exploded in the past couple of years has really made me realize that that's another passion of mine. And also kind of realizing, especially that I want to mentor female students after I started teaching and just seeing the disparity between my female students and my male students in terms of how much they speak in class, how much, you know, opportunities they want to take advantage of. I kind of realized that I wanted to focus on, a bit on mentoring female students to kind of help them get over the leadership gap.
That's really interesting. I did an MBA and I was in a cohort of students, about 30 students, 65% male. And I think I was the person who raised my hand the most, but I always felt embarrassed. It was like being the odd person out. It was like, it wasn't okay to talk.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are definitely women who do have the inclination naturally and are able to do it. But I think by and large, it's harder for women. There's some type of social ostracism, I think, that goes along with kind of being that louder female voice in a room. And I kind of wanted to address that and try to help my students with that. But yeah, it's difficult. I teach a large class, 250 students, and you know, I know that my students have a hard time, male or female, raising your hand in front of 250 people and answering a question doesn't come easy to most of us.
Right.
So I try to encourage that as much as possible, because I think especially regardless of what arena you want to go into, whether it's private sector, public sector, whatever it is, you're going to probably have to speak to large groups if you want to be in leadership positions. So why not use the opportunity in college, which is pretty much costless. It doesn't take away anything from their grade if they raise their hand and don't know the answer from undergrads in my class. So I try to get them to kind of, I try to create an environment where they feel safe to answer questions so they can start practicing that skill.
Wow. This is really great. I bet more people wish they had an economics professor like you. Mostly it's just formulas and supply demand charts,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think, and that's what makes me really sad when people say, when I say that I teach economics and people's response is like, ugh, I hated economics in undergrad. You know, that's a typical response. I hated it, you know. And to me, that's just so sad, because it really just means that you had a bad professor, at least a bad teacher, because it's so interesting. And you just have to kind of relate it to the world in a better way, you know. And you can see that with like the success of the book Freakonomics. Like once you kind of relate economics in kind of a more digestible way for people, it becomes much more interesting. So I think that shifting curves is important for 5 minutes, but typically I try to motivate the shifting curves with something that's actually going on in the world.
Wow, that's inspiring. I mean, I devoured economics. I loved it. My bachelor's degree is in economics, and it sort of catapulted me right into Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. catapulted me right out of it. I mean, for me, economics was public policy. So you mentioned loving developing countries and impoverished people, and then this passion for empowering women. Do you see those as two separate things, or are they intertwined at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the kind of connection is just some type of exclusionary sense. So in developing countries where you have, you know, fundamentally one of the basic problems is that financial markets aren't well developed. So even if you have a positive NPV project, you can't get a bank loan. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the central question in my research, which is what do companies do in developing countries that can't get money to finance investment?
Uh-huh. And let's just articulate for people, positive NPV is net present value. And that means you have a profitable idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the general idea is for like a very well-developed financial market like the U.S., if you have an idea for a project that should yield kind of positive profitability, then you should be able to get a loan if markets are efficient. So in developing countries, typically you have problems where markets aren't efficient. So even if you have this great idea for a new project or a new company, you can't get a loan. So I study primarily like what do companies do in that scenario. And that I largely came to because having this passion for developing countries, trying to pick like what problem am I going to try to solve? Is it going to be malaria? Is it going to be giving everyone a mosquito net? Is it going to be, you know, giving everybody condoms to prevent HIV? What's the problem that I think is the most essential? And what I got to was I don't think that you can lift a critical mass of people out of poverty without a functioning private sector, without companies that are employing people, without you know, products that are being made to help people in terms of sanitation, in terms of, you know, these essential problems.
Yes.
If you don't have, if people don't have bank accounts, you know, how do they possibly save money? Things like that. So that to me was the most salient issue. And that's what kind of led me to study this issue of kind of financial exclusion in developing countries from the firm perspective, which, so to connect it back to the empowerment, again, it's this, I think this idea of kind of exclusion that, that tugs at my heartstrings. Like, how do we kind of equalize opportunity for, whether it be for firms, whether it be for men and women?
Interesting, because one of the issues I have taken on in terms of empowering women is really encouraging them, when it's totally possible for us as women to build wealth. One of the things we know is that while we're masters at budgeting, we're not taking seriously our need to build a portfolio and own money that can sustain us. So very good. And speaking of empowerment, you recently published a really unique research study that was actually about the television show Shark Tank.
Yep.
What gave you the idea to put together this research?
So the idea honestly came about because I'm a Shark Tank junkie. And I was watching it and I realized something about the content of the show that's really interesting from a research perspective. And that is that you have failure. So most of the research on private equity funding, venture capital, angel financing doesn't have access to deals that failed to get a deal. So if you're by chance lucky enough to get data from this sphere, typically it's just on those deals that were funded.
So how, there are lots of entrepreneurs who ask for money, and it would be really valuable to you to know how many of them didn't get it.
Right, because then we can understand questions of like, what is correlated with not only how much money you get, which is the only question you can answer with the type of data that's only been available previously. Mm-hmm. So in addition to that, we can ask what determines the likelihood of getting a deal or getting funding at all, which is not a question that you can ask without failure data, because you don't have variation in whether you got a deal or not, if that makes sense.
Yes. And so what did you learn?
So we learned a couple of really interesting things. And I think that the most interesting thing is that women are, female teams are no less likely to get a deal, but they are, when they do get a deal, the amount that they get is substantially lower. So their valuations are substantially lower. So they actually give away both more of their company in terms of equity for lower dollar values. So that was kind of the first interesting thing that we found. But then we wanted to kind of try to understand, well, why is that? Maybe it's because, you know, this question of women go into industries that are less profitable or that are, you know, less likely to yield high returns. So maybe it's that. So we looked at that and we really didn't find that that's the case. What we found to be the strongest predictor of this amount of funding you're getting is actually the fact that women asked for less than their male counterparts. So in the show, you're able to kind of present a valuation of your company to the investors, and women by and large ask for less and value their companies lower than men.
This is incredible, this discovery that you have made. And there's so much that you just said. Can we unpack it a little bit?
Sure.
So first of all, women are equally likely, I mean, I feel like we could have a whole show on this. Women are equally likely to get money. And this flies in the face of, I think, what everyone thinks is true right now, which is that women and men are out there asking for money and that VCs and angel investors just aren't giving it to women.
Right, right.
And so is the conclusion we can take from this implicitly, you didn't say it, but is the conclusion that women aren't coming to the pitches?
No, I mean, so I think the difference is that, so one of the great things about this, about the data, is that actually that the difference in the number of male teams versus female teams is not huge. So it's something like somewhere in the 50s to the 40s percentage wise. So we were expecting that like 20% of the pitches will be by female teams, but it was actually much larger, which was great for us from a data perspective because it didn't affect us that it was just the fact that there were smaller number of female teams that could have kind of changed our story entirely. So that is perhaps less like the real world, I think, in terms of the stats that I've seen in terms of the percentage of women out there asking for money in the VC world. So it's a little bit larger than the average that isn't actually in the VC world.
What do you happen to know approximately what it would be in the VC, we'll call it the real world, VC or angel investor world?
I can't remember offhand. And honestly, it's such an important topic for me. Like, I don't want to say anything incorrectly.
Yeah.
So I'll just say that that data is out there. So I would point people to the data.
So, and then you said that women, so it is thought, it's probably said offhand, women are starting softer kinds of companies. They're fashion oriented or comfort oriented, baby products and like this. But what you've found is that women are starting profitable companies at the same rate as men. And these real profitable companies, I mean, the prime example is like a software company that scales infinitely. What were the other kinds of really profitable Shark Tank pitches that you saw?
Actually, the most successful Shark Tank company in the history of Shark Tank is actually the Scrub Daddy Sponge. Because again, you have to think about margins, right?
Yeah.
So the margins on that sponge, I guess, are crazy. So it's not exactly correlated with kind of how high tech your industry is. So industry was important in kind of determining how much money you're getting. But the fact of the matter is that we didn't see, there were a lot of consumer products on the show, and we didn't see that the breakdown within consumer products of male and female wasn't substantially different. Huh. So there were just as men pitching consumer products as there were women pitching consumer products.
Okay. And what are the ways that pitching an angel investor, I mean, I'm just going to assume most people listening to this show are not going to get the opportunity to be on Shark Tank simply because there's a small number of entrepreneurs that are
very
featured.
Hard, yeah.
So, but you do have the opportunity to get in front of angel investors, to get in front of VCs eventually. So what are the ways that pitching an angel investor isn't identical to the Shark Tank pitch process?
Is not identical?
Yeah. So if women were to go watch Shark Tank as an opportunity to get some education and training.
What's different?
I mean, I think I read in your research paper that you controlled for some of the ways that it's different. Like maybe there are stages or maybe it's more relationship contingent.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, we did do a lot of work. I mean, the biggest challenge in our paper was kind of trying to compare how much this is actually generalizable to obtaining investment funds otherwise outside of the show. Mm-hmm. So we did do a lot of work in that. And I think the ways in which it's, so a lot of Shark Tank you actually don't see. So there are hours of negotiations that you actually don't see on the show.
Oh, really?
So it's not as if it's only a 2-minute pitch and that's all there is. There are actually like hours of negotiations that occur prior to the sound bites that they take for the show.
So it is more real world.
So I think it is a little bit more real world than we're able to see. I think the ways that it's not real world in some ways it's becoming, I feel like, even more competitive because there is such an immediate impact on sales. So I think that, and there's something like 0.4% of people who apply actually get in front of the cameras. And then even after that, only a small percentage actually air. So we're talking about, you know, something like let's say 0.2 or 0.3% of the people who apply to be on the show actually are filmed and used on the air. So it is becoming extremely competitive to be on the show. I think other things that are different than reality are that, you know, there's much more due diligence over time that's done typically. You know, I think even if there is an hour or hours that we don't see, I think that there's a lot of due diligence that happens otherwise in the VC world that isn't happening on Shark Tank.
I mean, when I watch that show, it just seems to me like they make their decisions so quickly.
You know. But that's the magic of TV, too. I mean, it's, you know, it's all spliced together from like hours of discussion. I mean, I think what you mentioned is also true. I think that in a large respect, which is also very difficult for women, and I think one of the more insidious problems in gender gaps in general is this idea that the VC world is super socially kind of, you know, insular.
Yes.
Investors kind of know who's pitching what when, where, how, and people play golf together and kids go to school together and they talk together. And it's a very insular world. So I think that this actually Shark Tank is a little bit outside of that world, because I think that most of the companies that pitch are not the typical VC, necessarily the typical, at least high tech VC companies that are going to pitch.
And so if we break down, so if we call the problem an asking problem, women are not asking for enough. And it sounded to me like you put it in two categories. One is they don't ask for enough in a dollar sense, a real sense. Mm-hmm. And two is they give up too much equity in their company.
Right.
What would be your high level coaching to a woman who, I mean, let's just say she's pitching an investor and the most she can bring herself to ask for is, let's say, $1 million. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. Should women just ratchet that number up, or is there a more mathematical way to come to a better conclusion?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the idea for me, the takeaway is that I think women have this intuition to undervalue themselves and undervalue what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I do think like you should always negotiate. You should ask for potentially more than you think, than you kind of initially think. But I do think as best as possible that everything, the decisions that you make, these big decisions, should be supported by data. So I do think that as much as we can, you have to understand what your competitors' valuations are. What are, you know, other companies that are maybe not exactly what you're doing, but what are their valuations, or what were their valuations a couple of years ago, as best as you can. Mm-hmm. Try to write down these models of like, what were, you know, what are my competitors doing? To, you know, to get an educated guess of what your valuation should be.
Do you think it's a confidence problem?
Yeah, I think it's a confidence problem. I think it's, you know, I think in general, one of the disparities is also that I think outside of asking for driving directions, I think women have a harder time. I think women just have a harder time asking for things and asking for favors. And I think that, and this is just kind of my observation, is that women perceive asks as favors more than men do.
Okay, if you're an entrepreneur asking for investor dollars, there's a trade-off there. That's not just asking for money. That's asking for money in exchange for, you know, if things go well, I'm paying you back.
Yeah.
So women see that as asking for a favor too.
Yeah, I mean, I just think in the general day-to-day, like even in the workplace, when you're asking, you know, a mentor or a senior colleague to help you with something, you know, I think what I see even in my workplace, that I see that women perceive that as asking for a favor, mm-hmm. and men just ask for it. They just don't think it's a big deal. And whether, you know, and whether it's yes or no, they're fine to ask for it. And I think women have a little bit more of like a sense that it feels like they're asking the other person to extend themselves in a way that makes them uncomfortable. Huh. But that's just my perception. I think it all goes along with this idea that asking is more difficult for women.
Okay. And then to circle back, because mm-hmm. I don't want to leave it untied, but we talked about that you should, when you're asking for an amount of money from an investor, you should have some data about what are your competitors doing, what valuations are reasonable given where mm-hmm. you are in the company mm-hmm. lifespan. What about giving up equity or ownership of the company? Is the advice the same?
I mean, the advice is in general for your valuation, you're going to have to think about how much equity you want to give up. Mm-hmm. But I mean, equity is always, there's always a trade-off there. You know, how much control do you want to give up? How much of your company do you want to give up to begin with? You know, many entrepreneurs first starting out don't want to give up equity. A lot of the startups I know, at least in, you know, in Silicon Valley, if you're not one of the founders, you're getting like 0.04% equity when you first start.
Right.
So, you know, most companies, especially the small new companies, don't want to give up equity. And I think that's fine too. I mean, I think, you know, you can structure your company. I heard a great talk at a leadership conference by the founder of Stitch Fix, and she said her whole plan was to structure her company so she would never need outside funding. Mm-hmm. And while not everybody can be privileged enough to kind of never give up equity, you know, it is really a consideration to take seriously.
it's a big deal, especially when the numbers get big. And in terms mm-hmm. of negotiating, I recently sold a 10-year-old Lexus and I wanted $10,000. I'm going to be off a few dollars. But, you know, the mm-hmm. person who ended up buying the car started the negotiating at, I think, $7,500. And I said, no, you know, we're way off. We're way off.
Yeah.
And we ended up lower than I wanted to be. And my husband said to me, well, then you should have started higher. And of course, in retrospect, of course I should have started higher. And I think that the learning is the same here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's the idea that you always have to kind of, you always have to start higher, much higher than you kind of want to. And you have to find that happy place where you're not going to turn off the other person entirely, but still be high enough to kind of negotiate downwards.
Right.
And I think that's also knowing your investors. Knowing kind of what other investments do they make, what is their negotiating style, how much do they negotiate down. And again, these are all things, I mean, for someone who even wanted to go on Shark Tank, this is data you can collect of every pitch of every show and just, you know, simply do kind of like very basic statistics to understand like what does Mark Cuban do, what does Barbara Corcoran do in terms of negotiation. And that's knowing your investor. But again, that's like learning and collecting data on it.
Oh, that's great. It's really actionable and really insightful. So did you consider some of the more nuanced features of the ask, like the confidence with which it was delivered? Do you think that matters on Shark Tank?
Oh, I'm sure it does. We just have, it's very difficult to code that data.
Yeah.
What we tried to do is, I mean, we coded data, for instance, on did they have some expression of commonality with one of the sharks. So for instance, like every time somebody comes out and says they're from Pittsburgh, Mark Cuban is like, hey, Pittsburgh. So we try to like, you know, figure out whether that actually determines, you know, whether someone gets funded or how much they get funded. Uh-huh. We tried to kind of code these tacit commonalities. And that's actually the next paper that we're working on is kind of do commonalities between the investor and the entrepreneur change your chances of getting invested or not.
So then is it too early to ask if there were any surprises in the data like that?
I think we actually, preliminary evidence I think we have showing basically that gender plays a role, not shockingly. So female teams are more likely to be funded by the female investors.
Ah.
So, but that's, you know, that's very new. Well, we're working kind of more to flesh that out better, but that's one of the kind of commonalities that we're looking at.
So if you go on Shark Tank, you should definitely lie and say you're from Pittsburgh. Maybe not. That was just kidding. So then the message to women entrepreneurs is ask more frequently and ask for more, right?
Yep.
And are you teaching this in your classes now?
Am I teaching Shark Tank or am I teaching asking?
Asking.
I did actually present my co-author presented the Shark Tank results in my class, but asking, am I teaching asking? I don't teach asking directly, but I try to teach it kind of implicitly by trying to motivate my female students to speak up more in a very literal way.
Right. So have the results of this study caused you to ask for more in your own life?
Well, I mean, I was very aware of the gender disparity for a while now. So I've put this to use as well.
Okay. What are some examples of areas where you've put it to use?
Well, I negotiated my first salary.
Great.
Because I knew very well that, you know, your first salary basically determines your salary for the rest of your life.
Oh.
So I negotiated my first salary, which was nail biting. And I bought a house and I negotiated the price on the house. Yeah, so those were the kind of big ones I negotiated.
Those are big leverage points in your financial life.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I mean, when I read the article that was about your study, I was blown away. And so I'm so grateful that you would come on the show and share the results with us. And not only that, but kind of give us some insight into what it's like to be an Ivy League professor. To wrap it up, do you have a personal financial philosophy that you abide by or a bit of advice that you would give women?
I think, you know, in a general sense, being financially independent is of the utmost importance. And I think that it's always been extremely important to me. And it was instilled in me very early by my mom that you have to stand on your own two feet. You can't be you know, my sister wanted to be a writer, and my mom was like, you can be a writer as long as you're a lawyer on the side, because she had to be financially independent. So I think it's extremely important for women to be financially independent. And sometimes, you know, even in the example of my sister, in the face of doing what your passion is, sometimes you actually need to be reasonable in terms of what you can do and what you can afford, especially in terms of career choice. And then I think more kind of specifically, my financial philosophy, unfortunately, from taking a lot of finance classes, is pretty simple, and it's just about diversification. you know, it's kind of the fundamental law of any finance class. But so I try as best as I can to diversify
your investments, diversify your risks, diversify mm-hmm. your efforts.
Yeah. I mean, I have savings I actually use a company called Betterment for my savings. And I have my 401k, maxing out your 401k. I have a home. And so I try to kind of basically diversify my financial assets across a couple of different things.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. It's been really inspiring. And I know the folks out there are really going to appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Profit Boss, do you hate getting unsolicited advice? I kind of do. Whether it's well-intentioned or not, any kind of splaining just feels, I don't know, sort of aggressive and unwelcome. Of course, when I see someone who's important to me and they're struggling, sometimes it's tough to bite my tongue and just be there for them. So it's kind of a conundrum, right? We aren't here to run our friends' lives, no matter how well qualified we are to do it. On the other hand, if you discover something that's really made a difference to you, don't you just want to share it with everyone? I mean, it would be really presumptuous of me to just assume that my little podcast is something every listener just can't wait to share. But I do know what I hear from my listeners about how Profit Boss Radio has helped them to start changing old money habits and feel more in control and hopeful about getting out in front of their financial security. And I have to think that for every person I've reached, there are thousands more who might feel the same way if they get the chance. So if you're one of my listeners or in our Facebook group and you know at least one or two people in your social network could use an encouraging word, let me invite you to let them know about the podcast and about our Facebook group. Just hit the share button in your podcast app. It'll give you a good feeling, I promise, and you'll be helping me accomplish my big audacious goal of empowering a million women to take charge of their financial futures and become millionaires. Lastly, let me just say I'm truly honored to have earned a place in your busy schedule. I know you've got a lot of demands on your time and attention, and I'm so totally grateful for the little part of it that you share with me. So thank you, and let's get together next week for another episode of PBR.
Thank you for listening to Profit Boss Radio, where creating success on our own terms happens every day. You're not alone in your journey to a rich life, and that's why Hillary is here to add value in each and every episode. See you next time on the podcast for women and money.